It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. State test results show Wisconsin 3rd through 8th graders are reading about half a grade level behind where they did before the pandemic. Math scores haven't budged in that time either.
The latest education scorecard from the Center for Education Policy Research at Harvard University analyzed 38 different states. It found Wisconsin ranked in the bottom six for math and reading growth.
The report highlighted districts in the state that are seeing progress and outperforming their peers, including Fond du Lac, Cedarburg, and Waukesha.
What's driving those declines, and what are some districts doing to buck that trend? Corrine Hess is a Wisconsin Public Radio reporter who covers K-12 and higher education. Cori, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Give us the basics, Cori. What does this education scorecard tell us about Wisconsin students' performance in reading and math?
Well, you know, it tells us what we've known now for a few years. This is the fourth time the scorecard has been released. And, you know, Wisconsin parents are also given updates from state tests and other national tests. And all of these tests have shown them that since the pandemic, kids are behind.
What were some of the theories these researchers gave for why students are behind in Wisconsin and elsewhere in the country?
Researchers say that there was already a decline in student achievement, and then the pandemic hit, and they're calling that the pandemic just a mudslide for student achievement. And then when all of this happened, social media really began taking over children's lives, and, you know, it really has taken over our lives, too.
And these are longer-term trends they're looking at. They're comparing, you know, pre-pandemic to current times. These struggles in reading and math tests in Wisconsin aren't brand new. How long do the researchers say these concerning trends have been going on?
Yeah, they're not new. Like I said, the researchers said there was already a decline in student achievement, but then they've really seen a drop. You know, since about 2019, these numbers really started beginning to fall.
The research also looks at what I guess might be a related issue, chronic absenteeism across every district in the states they covered. What did we see in the report when it came to students who are absent a lot?
It's definitely related. We're finally seeing some improvement in chronic absenteeism. And of course, that's missing 10% of the school year. And so there was a high of 22% of kids missing more than 10% of the school year. That's now fallen to about 17%, but it's still a lot of kids not going to school as much as they should.
The report breaks things down in a lot of ways, race, gender, and income level. And this was interesting, I thought, Cori. This scorecard describes a U-shaped academic recovery at the national level when you look at income coming out of the pandemic. What do they mean by that?
Rob, I thought that was the most interesting thing, too. So the most improvement across districts were, of course, you know, in the highest income level districts, which wasn't that surprising, but also in the lowest income districts. And the reason for that was because those districts got the most federal funds during the pandemic. And the report found that without that money, those districts would have remained, you know, as far behind as they were during the pandemic. So it's these middle income districts that have actually seen the least improvement.
Cori, we've got more of your reporting on this at WPR.org. Thanks again for joining us.
Thanks so much.
That's Corrine Hess, WPR's education reporter, with us today to share the results of the latest Harvard University Education Scorecard. Measures how Wisconsin and other states are trending in math and reading test scores. Now we're turning our attention to one of the school districts that's seeing scores rise while other comparable schools have struggled. Matt Steinbarth is superintendent of the Fond du Lac School District. Matt, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, you are one of the districts around the country that this report highlighted doing pretty well, bucking these trends in a lot of ways. What do you attribute your success in these test scores to?
There's obviously a lot of factors. I think one of the first factors is our partnership with the University of Virginia Partnership for Leaders in Education. As we saw our scores continuing to decline, we knew we needed to do something different. And as was just recently stated, we had some money from the pandemic that we needed to invest to make some improvements and make them fast. And my predecessor I would say was smart enough to really do his homework, Dr. Flagg, and partnered with the University of Virginia. And at the time, I had been chief of schools, and we started putting some things in place with accountability for adults, students, and also just changed our system significantly from what we had been doing to what we're doing now.
From a parent or a student in your schools, what kind of changes would they have seen as this partnership with the University of Virginia was taking effect in your school?
I think one of the first things is the adult accountability. We have our principals are active in academic monitoring in the classrooms themselves, making sure that the teachers are staying true to the curriculum that we also invested in, and holding meetings in for backwards planning and looking at the data as it comes in from formative assessments and summative assessments to make plans to shift what that teaching maybe had looked like to get better results. And that level of accountability goes all the way from the district level down to the schools and individually into the classrooms and then directly impacting students. And I think that's really the biggest thing that we did. We invested money as well into having what we call TOSAs, teachers on special assignments, which allows, it's almost like a dean of students at the elementary level, and they handle a lot of the behavior issues that would come up in classrooms and in schools, and allow our principals to become the academic leaders that we had been saying they needed to be all along, but we didn't have the capacity because they got pulled into, again, behavior things, and things that maybe took them away from the academic focus.
I can imagine teachers who have been around for a while have seen a lot of the big new thing, the next buzzword or whatever come through, saying, okay, well, this is just the next one. This will come and go. What did you do as a district to get buy-in from teachers and school staff and principals for that matter?
Great question. One of the biggest things is at one of the UVA sessions in Oklahoma, we got the privilege of hearing Paul Bambrick speak, who is kind of renowned for making huge gains for students that need us most. And one of the things he had said to us was, sometimes you need to push the pedal really hard to make it happen, and there's going to be some adult discomfort along the way until they see the results that come in from what we've been asking them to do. And once those results start coming in, the attitude becomes contagious, and it just really takes over. And I think for us, and as you look at the report cards for us, you'll see one of our schools that was struggling the most, Parkside Elementary School, was in the bottom 1% of schools with academic growth. Within a 3 to 4 year time frame, they went from bottom 1% up to the 99th percent, and it didn't come without a cost. The first year, as the principal Amy Yan would say, in October, she lost five of her staff as we, had some high expectations for our teachers of what teaching and what the academic monitoring needed to look like, and it made some people uncomfortable. But after that first year, we saw a slight gain in student achievement and a lot more in growth. And then the second year, it grew even more. And as I said, now they're in the 99th percentile and just going strong with what we do for kids.
One concern about standardized testing and the No Child Left Behind program that led people to turn against it somewhat was this idea that, hey, are we just teaching to the test, right? Are we teaching kids to be good at taking these tests and our scores go up, but we don't really know if they're learning things? What would you say to people say, yeah, the test scores are good, but are kids really absorbing stuff? Are they really learning their reading and math?
What I would say is come into one of our schools, and I'd love to be able to show them the levels that students were able to communicate with us and feel success. I think one of the biggest things that we've also learned is really celebrating those successes for students and giving them that belief that they can do hard things. And sometimes that's school, sometimes that's things out of school. So by showing that growth can happen, it doesn't matter if it's academic or if it's in a sport or in music. You have to get used to feeling uncomfortable to learn something new. And I think that feeling is something our students are getting more comfortable with all the time, and our adults as well. And so I think that just goes along with them later in life as well, that they can achieve difficult things if they set their mind to it and keep working through the struggles.
One concern in this national report card was the impact of social media and kids on phones. We have this statewide phone requirement, no phones in the classroom now. Your thoughts on social media, phones, and their impact on kids learning?
Absolutely. As I was listening to the segment before that, I couldn't agree more with the other individual that said, even as adults, we struggle with that. And, you know, we are a district as well that just recently failed two referendums. I attribute a lot of that to social media and some negative publicity we had been getting on that from people that don't have students directly impacted in our school system. They believe it's the district is what it was 10 years ago, 15 years ago even, and they don't keep up with what we're doing right now. And that social media, it takes people away from the communication that should be happening person to person and finding out the details, because everybody can put something on social media, whether it's true or not. And it does take a lot of focus away from the great work that's happening at times.
Speaking of school funding, I got to ask, we came into yesterday, it looked like schools were going to get some money from the state budget surplus. We come into today, it looks like they're not. What's your reaction to that roller coaster this week on the state budget surplus plan?
Yes, I had a few different news stations come in and talk about that. And, you know, a lot of the talk had been, hey, this is a conversation and a, you know, joint effort to get this to happen. And how excited are you? And I did say at that time, I'm not going to get too excited until I see the vote come through. And even though I'll be honest, I was hoping that that would go through, because the special ed funding alone would have helped us tremendously. Again, as a district that just has recently failed two referendums and getting the results that we're getting, we're at a stage right now where last year we had to reduce by 70 staff, and this year we're reducing by another 30. So with these results, when you reduce by 100 staff, that takes a toll, and we're going to keep working hard to keep the results as they are. But again, that money that would have come in just from special education alone would have saved us from being in a deficit again in 2 years. So,
Matt, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
That's Matt Steinbarth, superintendent of the Fond du Lac School District. He was with us today to share how his district is performing better than many others in the state when it comes to reading and math test scores and improvement over time, including according to a new national report. Earlier, we heard from WPR education reporter Corrine Hess.
Coming up, Wisconsin school districts must roll out new student cell phone bans by July. Will it help? Results from Middleton High School's policy.
Students are on TikTok, they're on Snapchat, they're watching a show on YouTube, and staff can't compete with that. And so removing that from the classroom environment has allowed students to kind of re-engage.
And a new national report on the impact of those phone bans, that's next. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Wisconsin recently became the 36th state to enact a law limiting cell phone use in K-12 schools.
The measure passed with bipartisan support. And when Governor Evers signed the bill, he said that cell phones can be, quote, a major distraction from learning, a source of bullying, and a barrier to our kids' important work of just being a kid.
In a bit, we'll hear from two Wisconsin school districts about how they're implementing cell phone bans ahead of a July deadline.
First, what impact do cell phone bans have on student learning and well-being?
The National Bureau of Economic Research has published the largest study to date that tries to tackle that question.
Here with us to discuss that research is Brian Jacob. He's a professor of public policy, economics, and education at the University of Michigan, where he co-directs the Youth Policy Lab. He's also co-author of the report called The Effects of School Phone Bans. Brian, thanks for joining us.
Hello. Glad to be here.
You and fellow researchers analyzed data from over 40,000 schools to discern whether or not these schools' cell phone bans are effective. What did you evaluate to get to an answer to a really complex question?
Well, we were looking specifically at one way in which schools can restrict student cell phone use. This is via lockable pouches, where students at the beginning of the school day put their phones in a pouch. It is magnetically sealed, and they are not supposed to be able to access it until the end of the day when they unlock it before they leave school. And so we were studying the effect of schools adopting the use of these lockable pouches in a few recent school years.
In terms of what you found, what are some big takeaways from the study of schools that use these lockable pouches and the outcomes on students?
So we found a mixed pattern of effects. I think most importantly, kind of, and firstly, we found that schools that adopted these pouches saw a pretty substantial decline in student phone use. We can measure that both with teacher reports, where teachers reported about an 80% decline in students using their phones for personal reasons during class. We also measured that via GPS, like cell phone ping data, that we got from a company that tracks cell phone mobility. So that was one effect. We also found that kind of teachers in schools that adopted the pouches kind of were generally satisfied and kind of happier than they were prior to pouches. We also found evidence of some what we think of as short-run disruption effects. So in the first year that the pouches were adopted, we see a kind of an increase in student disciplinary incidents, you know, something equivalent to roughly a 16% increase in student suspensions. And we think, you know, this might be due to a variety of factors. This could be due to actually enforcing the bans and kind of student resistance to following the new rules. Mm-hmm. It could also be due to the fact that students were now kind of more engaged with each other. And when they didn't have their phones to kind of occupy them, they were more likely to get into conflict with other students. But importantly, we saw that kind of increase in disciplinary incidents kind of faded in year two and three and went back to kind of the standard levels that it had been before the policy.
Everyone was so curious about what might happen to test scores. What did you find out about test scores?
Well, there we found not much of an effect. We found the introduction of pouches really led to no significant increase in either math or English language test scores. And that is, that's, I know, going to be disappointing to some. I think it's a little bit puzzling because there certainly had been evidence to suggest that cell phones were distracting students and leading to worse academic outcomes. But I think that's why we have to do this research, because we don't always know the answers ahead of time.
When you think about the effectiveness of a cell phone policy, like a phone ban, it seems like some of the changes happen right away. Others may take time. Do you expect to see different or additional outcomes as these policies take hold in future years?
I certainly wouldn't be surprised. I mean, as I think, as you know, in Michigan and as in Wisconsin and other places, there's lots of activity on schools trying to figure out the best way to restrict student cell phone use and what that means for other school rules, for curriculum, for pedagogy. And I think there's going to be a learning curve. I think schools will hopefully get better in figuring out ways to, you know, effectively restrict student phone use, and then, as importantly, figure out how to make use of kind of students' hopefully newfound attention going forward.
Brian, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you very much.
That was Brian Jacob, professor of public policy, economics, and education at the University of Michigan. We've been talking about his research looking at school cell phone bans around the country. Now, Wisconsin recently became the 36th state to enact a law restricting student cell phone use in schools. Around the state, many school districts have already put their own policies in place. Middleton Cross Plains Area School District has had its phone restriction policy since 2024. Bobby Reinhardt is principal of Middleton High School. Bobby, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Middleton High School has had a stricter cell phone policy in place for a couple years now, and before the state had passed any laws. Why do you think the district was an early adopter of a policy to try to remove cell phone distractions during class time?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think we got out in front of it because we were really seeing the impact on students' mental health that our cell phones were having on the students in our building. And so we, as an administration team, looked at what we could possibly do to remove cell phones without any legislation. We saw a few schools nationwide that were doing it and decided to jump on that track as well, really trying to limit cell phone use during the day for students' mental health and so that we could increase engagement in the classroom.
Right, because, you know, district to district, you see different takes on this. Some have a classroom ban. Others have adopted the bell-to-bell policy with phones out of sight all day. What does this look like at Middleton High School?
Yeah, so we really operate under during learning time, during the classroom periods, we have a cell phone ban. And so when students enter the classroom, teachers have different procedures they use in their classroom to either collect the devices or make sure that the devices are off and away. And so we give teachers autonomy with that so that they can set up their spaces in the way that they need to. But the expectation is during the learning block, our students do not have their cell phones out and they're not being used.
Does that put the onus on students, remembering, you know, how it works for each classroom with each teacher?
It does, yeah. And I would say we have just a few different ways that teachers are implementing that policy in their own space. So either a teacher has a common space where cell phones are physically being collected. So as a school, we spent some resources on making sure that we had devices where students could put their cell phones in a safe area where they can be locked up so that we didn't have to worry about things being stolen or walking off on their own. So students felt comfortable with that. The other way that staff operate are they expect that students keep them in their backpack. So that's another option that staff have. And that takes away the necessity for staff to feel like they are responsible for those expensive devices. And it really does put the ownership on the student to keep them in their backpack, again, off and away so that they're not being used.
What have you learned since, you know, this policy came to being? You probably have seen some challenges, some roadblocks, but you've also had some aha moments.
Yeah, I think challenges up front really started with safety. When parents were first communicated about this, their main concern was what happens in the event of something where I need to get a hold of my student right away. And so we definitely spent time communicating with families, letting them know that they will have access to their cell phones in cases of an emergency. And we make that very clear in our policy that in certain circumstances, we will allow students to have their phones so that they can communicate home. I think the things that have outweighed that significantly are the level of engagement that we're seeing in the classroom. You walk into a classroom, it could be a gymnasium for a Phi-Ed class, it could be a math classroom or an English classroom, and the levels of engagement that we're seeing are significantly increased. We always like to say it is almost impossible for a teacher to have to navigate and compete with a device, right? Students are on TikTok, they're on Snapchat, they're watching a show on YouTube, and staff can't compete with that. And so removing that from the classroom environment has allowed students to kind of re-engage and continue to focus on those soft skills and learning how to collaborate and communicate with one another since they don't have that distraction constantly in front of them.
I would imagine it's anecdotal, but have you seen students' mental health improve that you can connect to these phones being away from them?
Yeah, we're looking for ways to try to look at some concrete data to show that. But I would say so, yes. And although we do allow cell phones to be used during passing time and during the lunch hour, the fact that they are not using them during the classroom time does kind of remove a significant chunk of time where those things can happen, right? They're getting that needed break from the device, not constantly seeing what's on social media. We all know kind of what comes from the messaging that's on social media and what that does to students' mental health. And so I would say that we have seen a slight decrease in some of those issues that come up due to the devices, just based on how little students are able to use them during the school day.
And what happens if a student breaks the policy and either brings their phone to class or is found to violate how a teacher wants them to be handled in the classroom?
Yeah, it's kind of a running joke amongst students and amongst staff, but it's almost a verb. It's kids get green slipped. So if they have a cell phone out in the classroom, or if they have it in the hallway during a classroom period, any staff member in the building can hand a green slip to a student. And the green slip is not meant to be a punitive action. It's meant to be a reminder that, hey, in this building during learning time, we don't use cell phones. And so that reminder, truly the first time is a reminder. And then if there are multiple infractions, students do lose access to their device and they have to turn it in when they arrive at school, or the family has to make a plan with the school to verify that the cell phone won't be coming to school. And so that's something that our deans and our security staff are constantly working on, is making sure that we're collecting the phones in the morning of those students who need to turn them in because they were having an issue with the cell phone, and then making sure that we're following through with families so that they're aware, so that they can partner with us in navigating the policy.
Bobby, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
That was Bobby Reinhart, principal of Middleton High School. We've been talking about eliminating cell phones from classrooms. Middleton Cross Plains Area School District rolled out its cell phone policy in 2024. Now to Madison Metropolitan School District, the second largest district in the state. Currently, it does not have a blanket policy in place, but is working to roll one out before a July 1st deadline. A new Wisconsin law known as Act 42 requires public school boards to adopt policies by July that prohibit students from using their cell phones during class time, with some exceptions for emergencies. TJ McCray is Deputy Superintendent of the Madison Metropolitan School District. TJ, thanks for joining us.
You know, thank you so much for inviting me and allowing me this opportunity today.
Madison is the largest school district in the state that doesn't yet have a cell phone policy on the books. What is at play here for why Madison hasn't implemented a district-wide policy?
I think it's important to note that while we have not had a formal policy, we have had, well, I like to say we haven't had a policy with a capital P. We've had a policy with the lower P. So all of our schools, especially in our secondary, since 2022, have had some form of lowercase P policy. What we're moving to now is really that capital P policy, which is our board is implementing and kind of codifying a lot of the work that we've already been doing and the things that we need to do in response to Act 42.
There is a fine line between keeping students engaged in the classroom, away from their screens, and also being over-controlling as a district. What are the biggest challenges to creating a district-wide capital P policy?
I think right now what our biggest challenge is creating a policy that really will do some of the things that you talked about. How are we making sure we're keeping our students safe? How are we also making sure that we can continue to engage them, recognize that our main priority is providing them with that educational opportunity experience that they need and deserve more than anything. So I think that those are some of our biggest struggles that we're working through right now.
And what has come up? Because you have teachers at play, you have the parents who are talking to you, and you have the students themselves. What are some of the issues that come up as you craft this policy?
I think the biggest thing is how do we unify some of those voices? I mean, you yourself right there have just said, name three different voices. And if you were to bring those voices into a room, they all want three different things. Students don't want their cell phones removed. Parents wanted it to look a certain way, and teachers would want to look a certain way at the same time. So it's how do we find that common ground to support what we need to do for our students?
What have you crafted in case of emergency? If a student sees an emergency, think there's a threat, what will happen in that case as you work through this policy?
Yeah, I think we're still working through that. What we know is that we have a policy that will allow students access to their phones in case of some form of emergency or an assumed emergency. So right now, we're just in a place where we're really drafting a policy. And then over the course of the next couple of weeks and months, we're going to continue our work to really be thinking about implementation to ensure that the policy is implemented with consistency across all of our campuses. So we're continuing that work. We're going to continue to work with one of the UW students to really flush out that implementation phase. And so we still need to tighten up on that.
So the Madison School District enlisted the help of UW-Madison to do a study about cell phone bans, and the report is out. What was the most useful thing to come out of that report as a district moves forward with crafting a policy?
For me, I think one of the biggest things that really came out was the research from the students, not just the research of what and where we are or are not. But I think what was so critical for me is just like learning from other districts and how they implemented. Thinking about how we need to ensure like our behavior data, what that's going to look like over the next couple of years as we implement it. Because what the students showed us was that there is a spike in those discipline behaviors. And so what are we going to do to kind of make sure that we are addressing those as soon as possible? So one of the things that we're looking to start doing is communicating with our stakeholder as early as often as possible over the course of the summer, just so that everyone is aware of it. Now, I recognize like that isn't the silver bullet, but we want to make sure we can start crafting communications as early as possible. How are we allowing our parents to engage with students to engage with those conversations as well? And so we're hoping we can kind of curtail some of that.
And the clock is ticking for that July 1st deadline. What needs to be resolved in the coming weeks?
In the coming weeks, we have a policy for our board members. So we had the first read. We have to have an additional read, and then the board must vote on it. So we're hoping that our June instructional work group will be the second read. And then at our June general board meeting, the board will move forward with the final vote.
TJ, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That is TJ McRae, Deputy Superintendent of the Madison Metropolitan School District. Earlier, we heard from Middleton High School Principal Bobby Reinhart and Public Policy Professor Brian Jacob from the University of Michigan. We've been talking about school cell phone bans ahead of Wisconsin's new law going into effect on July 1st.
Coming up, Milwaukee thriller author Nick Petrie shares his newest novel and what it takes to tell an exciting story.
I'm just writing the book that I want to read. I'm just trying to entertain myself, because if I'm not entertaining myself, I'm not entertaining my readers.
That's next here on WPR News.
You're listening to Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. An endorsement from President Donald Trump can serve as a golden ticket in Republican primary elections.
But that has not been the case so far in northern Wisconsin's 7th Congressional District. Trump endorsed 26-year-old Michael Alfonso, the son-in-law of U.S. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy.
As Rich Kramer reports, that has frustrated some conservatives and emboldened Alfonso's GOP opponents.
On an unseasonably warm day in late April, around 30 Republicans slowly filed through the open doors at the Mercer Community Center, less than a half hour south of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. They were there for a 7th Congressional District debate put on by the Iron County Republican Party. On stage sat GOP candidates Jesse Eben, Kevin Hermaning, and Nina Baum. To their left was a sign with the name Michael Alfonso taped to an empty chair. Moderator Bruce Marcus wasted no time asking them about the president's endorsement from January, in which he called Alfonso a mega warrior from a great family.
Could I conceivably say, what are you guys doing in the race? You like Trump so much, why don't you endorse Alfonso?
Each candidate responded by praising Trump, but Hermaning, a 66-year-old financial planner and former Marine, ripped Alfonso for attending a Washington, D.C. fundraiser instead of the debate.
We're not supposed to, on the front end, before we're even there, be proven to be part of the swamp.
And Eben, a 36-year-old executive with Ashley Furniture, referenced an article about transportation industry lobbyists donating to Alfonso's campaign.
I don't think the district, I mean, I've heard it directly, appreciates nepotism, appreciates a rolled-out carpet, and appreciates a candidate funded by the swamp specifically for transportation dollars.
Alfonso is new to politics, and critics have knocked his lack of experience. At age 26, he'd be the youngest member of Congress. For his part, Alfonso is portraying his youth as a positive, and in a joint podcast interview, his wife, Evita Duffy Alfonso, said it gives voters hope.
And when they see somebody like Michael campaigning and espousing the kind of values that he has, it makes them feel okay about the future.
Alfonso has outraised his opponents with Sean Duffy's help. His money, connections, and Trump's endorsement would be enough to win most GOP primaries. In the 7th District, that's not yet clear. Longtime Republican strategist Bill McCoshin grew up in Superior. He said this might be the one district where Trump's endorsement is not decisive because the people of northern Wisconsin are very independent.
They don't like to be told what to do. And I think it's a mistake, frankly, for Alfonso to not participate in those debates. He's a smart young man. He can hold his own.
Another factor in the race, Eben and Hermaning have the financial resources to compete. Eben has $1 million PAC backing her, and Hermaning loaned his campaign $1 million. There are three Democrats, Ginger Murray, Chris Armstrong, and Fred Clark, also vying for the seat. Clark served in the Wisconsin Assembly and said the district is in play because residents are sick of political hatred.
My goal is to reach every thoughtful voter that I can and make the appeal that a Democrat could actually represent you. You wouldn't have to give up your values, but you might actually see a federal government that works better for you.
Joe Hendrick, a longtime Republican elections expert, grew up in Minocqua and has done work for Hermaning. He said people think of the 7th District as a safe GOP seat. Hendrick stopped short of that.
If the Republicans had a poor candidate, it is possible Democrats could win this seat.
But Hendrick says the winner of the GOP primary in August is likely to win in November, which is why there's so much focus on that race. Back in Mercer, Iron County Party Chair Tanner Hiller says he tried to get Alfonso to agree to his event. He says he was told the presidentially endorsed candidate doesn't need to debate.
There's a lot of people that have better credentials, that know this district, that will represent this district better than Michael Alfonso. And I tried to give him a benefit of the doubt and get his opinion on matters, and he didn't show up.
Weeks after the debate, Hiller endorsed Hermaning. Alfonso's campaign did not respond to WPR's request for an interview. For now, he's touring the district and running an aggressive social media campaign. It includes an appearance in an online reality show with his father-in-law, the DOT secretary, and President Donald Trump, his endorser-in-chief. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is WPR News.
An investigative reporter faces death threats for unknown reasons, putting herself and her daughter at risk. She gets unexpected help from a military veteran in town from Milwaukee.
That's the opening chapter of Milwaukee author Nick Petrie's new novel. It's called The Dark Time, and it's the 9th novel in Petrie's Peter Ash series. The series started with The Drifter, set in his hometown.
I talked to Nick Petrie earlier this spring about his new novel and the experience of writing in and about his hometown. Well, start, Nick, by introducing us to your main character, Peter Ash.
My main character is a guy named Peter Ash, who's a Marine Corps veteran who's come home from his wars in Iraq and Afghanistan with a pretty significant dose of post-traumatic stress. So the first books in this series are really Peter coping with that while having various adventures and helping people out. You know, I came to this from talking with lots and lots of vets in my former life about their experiences coming home from war. And I realized I just wanted to explore that and wanted to help other people understand that.
Let's start there. Peter, as you say, is a veteran. That's very important to him as a character. You're very upfront that you're not a veteran yourself. Tell us a little more about how you tried to make sure you represented his experiences as authentically as you could.
Well, I was deeply insecure about my ability to do that. And this book I never honestly thought would get published. When I was a home inspector, I had clients coming home from war who, because I was a safe person to talk to, not part of their family, not part of their service family, they would, you know, tell me stories because they were basically never going to see me again. And so I heard these fragments of tales, and I had to really, I did a lot of research and I ended up reaching out very deliberately to people to make sure that I was sort of capturing this correctly. And the crazy thing to me is that the response that I have gotten from that community has been overwhelmingly positive.
What kind of things have you heard from veterans who have read your work, read Peter's experience, and maybe seen it reflecting their own?
I guess I've had two sort of basic responses. One, I was at an event at the Greenfield Library for The Drifter, my first book, and two older women came up to me. They were sisters, and they said that their husbands had both been in Vietnam, and reading my book had helped them understand how to talk to them about their war. So that's part of it is the, you know, family, loved ones of vets. The other piece is vets themselves. The one that really sticks with me is I got a Facebook message from a young man who said that he'd spent the better part of the summer trying to figure out the best way to kill himself. But then someone had given him my book and he had realized that he wasn't going crazy. He just had post-traumatic stress. And now he was getting help. And this was just sort of a thank you note. And he included with it a picture of him and his wife and his three little kids. And that, like, I never expected that to be a part of these books. My goal is to write something that's fast and fun and entertaining. But there is this piece of the world that I think a lot of people don't get. You know, we are 10% of Americans really have served in the military, and far fewer than that have been in combat. And it's a, you know, I think it would help us all to think about how we want to engage with the world. By realizing what the true costs of it might be.
Now, Milwaukee is the setting for the opening book in the series, The Drifter. It's kind of a home base, even as Peter's story takes him around the country and beyond in some cases. What was it like turning your own home base into the setting for the first Peter Ash novel?
Oh, that's a bunch of fun. I get to highlight the parts of the city that I know and love. You know, Peter grabs a burrito in my favorite burrito joint. He stops for coffee at the coffee places I like. And the reaction from the community is really quite something, because Milwaukee, this isn't Chicago or New York. We don't have sort of a built-in community of crime writers talking about our city. So it's fun to, you know, kind of hear from people who are like, oh, I know that part of the town. I've been by that house. I've been, you know, through that neighborhood. So it's a bunch of fun.
Now, Peter's adventures have taken him outside of Wisconsin. Seattle's the setting for The Dark Time, the newest book in the series. How do you go about learning a setting, like in this case, Seattle, to present it with as much confidence as you can with Milwaukee?
Well, Seattle was easy because I lived there for 10 years. It's been a long time since I lived there, but I've been back repeatedly. So Seattle kind of feels like home for me. But normally, most of these books take place someplace different, and I always have to go there because you don't know what a place smells like. You can't learn that online. You can't know how a place is going to feel. I went to Memphis to research my fourth book, Tear It Down, and all of the flowers had fallen from the tulip trees and were rotting in the gutters, and it was just a great kind of metaphor for sort of what Memphis is like now, which is a lot like how we think about Detroit. It's sort of crumbling from within.
Milwaukee author Nick Petrie is with us talking about his Peter Ash series of novels. The latest book is The Dark Time. Nick, one thing that struck me in The Dark Time, and this kind of goes against a lot of action movie things you see, Peter has, I guess, what they call gun discipline, right? You've got a scene early on. It looks like it's going to be an old-fashioned good guy, bad guy shootout. Bad guy's shooting at him. Peter has a gun. Okay, this is where they shoot at each other, right? No, Peter looks at his surroundings, holds his fire. He sees a bystander over there, somebody in a window over there. I thought that was really interesting. What led you to have Peter be that guy instead of what we might expect in that action scene?
Well, you know, the movies are not terribly realistic for the most part. People who are trained with weapons, this is part of the training, is they really learn to think before they shoot, at least if they're well-trained. And, you know, if you're going to have a gunfight in the middle of a, you know, populated area, you can't have the good guy, just from a purely sort of narrative standpoint, you know, killing somebody by accident. That it's not, you know, it really kind of ruin your relationship with the character. It's part of how I want to, you know, kind of show that there's a real difference between somebody who, you know, buys a gun at a local gun store and just, you know, sort of starts shooting, and somebody who really is trained for, you know, that skill. And it's a, you know, it's a crazy thing. Guns are dangerous. It's good to have some training.
Let's get into the writing craft. As a writer, how do you pace and structure a thrilling story that keeps, well, kept me turning the pages, I'll say that.
Well, I'm glad it entertained you. You know, I'm what's called a pantser rather than a plotter. I don't outline before I start a book. I just write kind of by the seat of my pants. And so really I'm trying to entertain myself. And so I you know, get my word count for the day, and then at the beginning of the next day, I go back over the previous couple of days' work and I hone it down and I think, okay, does this dialogue need to be expanded? Is it doing more than one thing? Is it, you know, does this action sequence fast enough, or should it slow down? Should there be a moment of rest afterward? It really is just sort of this constant writing revision process. But I'm just writing the book that I want to read. I'm just trying to entertain myself, because if I'm not entertaining myself, I'm not entertaining my readers.
Now, you mentioned crime novels, a lot of people in Chicago and New York writing them. We think of the publishing world on the coasts. How is Wisconsin for you as a place to be an author?
Wisconsin's great. It's a very easy place to live. It's an affordable place to live. I couldn't make a living at this, you know, trying to live in Brooklyn, for example. You know, the world is, you don't have to live in the center of the world anymore to have an impact. And our local bookstore in Milwaukee, Boswell Books, is a wonderful place and very supportive. Mystery to Me in Madison, where I've been for every book as well, is a wonderful crime fiction bookstore. You know, again, the community here has really, you know, kind of reached out to support me, because we don't really have anybody doing, you know, sort of this kind of thing in Milwaukee. There are a couple of newer writers coming up who are really great. Amy Pease in Madison is super talented. Her second book just came out in January.
Do you feel like there is this community of authors here who are willing to, as you just did, lift each other up?
Oh, sure. You know, the crime fiction community is a super supportive place. So I have had the benefit of, you know, making friends with, you know, really people who are at the top of the bestseller lists, who have been doing this for a long, long time. And, you know, I reach out and ask for advice, and people have been very generous with me. And so I'm trying to kind of pay it forward to people who are a little bit newer in the business, and to help them. You know, I've had to learn some hard lessons along the way, and if I can help somebody avoid that, I will.
Nick, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Rob. I appreciate it.
That was Milwaukee author Nick Petrie. His latest book is The Dark Time. That's the ninth book in his Peter Ash series, which started with The Drifter, based in Milwaukee. He's scheduled to speak at the Rhinelander Public Library on Friday, May 29th at 6 p.m. And we always want to hear from you about books or movies or TV shows that are set, totally or in part, here in Wisconsin. Do you have a favorite moment of a fictional representation of our state you want to share with us? Or is there one that stands out for you that really gets Wisconsin wrong? Tell us about it. You can email us. WisconsinToday@WPR.org is the address. Again, that's WisconsinToday@WPR.org with your Wisconsin moments in books, TV shows, and movies.
Earlier this week, we met the first ever person named Cartoonist Laureate of Wisconsin. Paul Noth told us about his career and his success at getting his work published in The New Yorker. And we asked about your favorite comic strips.
Celia tells us she is a fan of New Yorker comics and lots of funny papers. Her favorite memory is of a Mad Magazine holiday strip where a homeowner climbs up his chimney to tell Santa, "Get those reindeer off my roof."
And a listener named Bob called in to say his favorite cartoon series was The Far Side. He says the absurdist comics by Gary Larson are pertinent to real life.
That's what I forgot to mention the other day on my list of the comics I used to always read first.
And we still want to hear from you. What are your favorite comic strips, past or present? Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org or call or text at 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today producers include Lauren Cox and Rochelle Wilson.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.